I'm Holly. I'm an alcoholic. I feel very privileged to be here tonight, and thank you, Colleen, for asking me to speak. I'm not in jeans and a t-shirt tonight because I was taught by the old-timers that I should suit up as well as show up, and so that means, you know, me coming as somebody that is not hungover. Just, you know, this is what the program has taught me, so these are some of the tools that I use today. I'll tell you what it was like and what it's like now, and I'll start off with some facts because I'm always curious when people are up at the podium. How old are they? How long have they been sober? I'm 34 years old, and I have 11 years of sobriety. So I came into the rooms when I was 23 years old, which I thought I was really, really old at the time, and that I had drank for a really long time. That's how tired I was. I was exhausted, actually. I was 12-stepped into the program, which means that I met another alcoholic who was in the rooms of AA. He had many, many years of sobriety at the time, and basically he told me his story. And after I got over the fact that I was so embarrassed that he had told me all these, what I thought were intimate details of his life, which was that he was drunk and now he wasn't, I realized how much I was identifying with him. You know, I don't have the same story as him, but I really identified with the feelings of why he drank and then, you know, how his life was so different when he got sober. And this man that presented me, I actually didn't even believe everything he was saying because I couldn't believe that he, this, you know, well-dressed, successful, working person, was the same as me, the throwing up, holding my hair back person I was at that point. So how did I get to be at that point? I grew up in a very loving home. My parents are wonderful people. I had lots of hugs and kisses growing up and that kind of stuff. My father had a wonderful job. We had enough money. We had a nice home. My mother chose to stay home. She was, the new term is hover mother. You know, she was like a helicopter hovering over me all the time. You know, where are you going? What are you doing? What was in school? Who'd you talk to? This kind of stuff. But it was because she was, you know, so loving, so nurturing. That's what her main purpose in life was, to give me this self-confidence and to bring me up so that I could really have this amazing life. And as hard as she tried to do that, I believe today that I was born an alcoholic. And what that means to me was that before I even took the first drink, I was exhibiting these signs of alcoholism. What I've learned is alcoholism, which is, you know, an allergy of the body, but an obsession of the mind. So although I didn't have the allergy within me because I wasn't ingesting the alcohol, I had this obsession. So I used to, you know, arrange things in my bedroom. And, you know, my friends would come over and they'd move them. And I'd know. And I'd have to move them back. And, you know, it was like this total control thing going on. I remember trying to start a club when I was like 8. And I invited some girls over after school and I'd made up the rules and, you know, this is what we're going to do, and I'm going to be the president, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of it, it was sort of like, you know, all those, you know, in favor say aye, and it was like dead silence in the room, you know. I was always, I always had to be amused. That was the other thing. Like, I'm an only child, and unfortunately my mother suffered from depression. And I remember her sitting me down at a very young age and saying, you know, I love you and I'll buy you all the toys, but I'm not going to play them with you at all. And she kept her word. My mother didn't play games. She didn't want to do it. And so I had like a whole closet full of toys. I was obsessed with Lego and Star Wars. So I'd build like Lego villages and have my Star Wars action figures, you know, going through them. Like, these were the things I did. I just constantly had to be amused and be creative and all these types of things. I'm hesitating telling this, but it's a part of my story. When I was 8, I was left with a male babysitter. And although nothing physically happened, he chased me around the house for 4 hours trying to have something physically happen. And, it scared the hell out of me, obviously. And I tried to tell my parents about it, and nothing was done. We were in another city at the time, and I guess they kind of thought, I'll never see him again. Obviously, they'll never leave me with him again, and it was kind of brushed under the rug. And within that year, I went to a party, and there was lots of drinking. It was, you know, I was always around adults, and there was lots of drinking, and he was there. And he was drinking. He was 12. And so I decided that I'm going to drink whatever he's going to drink, you know, because I'm 8 and a half, and that's how I roll. And so I got completely smashed. And I don't totally remember how I got from here to there, but I ended up in the pool, and I remember my father pulling me out by one arm, being very disappointed in me, however I was acting. And later that night, I threw up in a sink because I didn't know what a toilet bowl was anymore. And my father found me, and he said, you know, buddy, I think you have the flu. And I was like, oh, you know, so I'll clean it up, and you go back to bed, and we don't have to tell mommy about it, because her mother, you know, she would have had every test done on me that I had the flu kind of thing. And he's just like, and that'll be the end of it. And so I have to tell you, from the time I was 8 and a half to the time I stopped drinking at 23, I thought I had the flu. Because every time I put alcohol in my body and I had an allergy to alcohol, I threw up. And I am a smart person. You know, I went to university. I never made the connection between alcohol and throwing up. It was spaghetti. It was the garlic bread. It was the drinking on an empty stomach. It was drinking too much. It was the killer Kool-Aids. It was the shots. Oh, it was the beer. It was like all these things that I kept eliminating because I couldn't come to terms with the fact that something that made me feel so good was destroying me. That was just, I couldn't make that connection. So, well, those 15 years, do I really have to tell you about them? They were in a toilet bowl. I mean, you know, I had a great time and I had a lot of vomiting. That was basically the summary of my drinking. I was on all sorts of sports teams. I was on music club, drama club. Like I said, I had to be amused all the time. I was on the student body. I was constantly running from activity to activity. And I never wanted to stay home and stay put. You know, I remember my mother saying to me, like, do you have to go out again? Like, you've been out every night this week. And it was like, well, if I stay home and I'm sober at this point, by the time I'm 15, 16, I might have to start thinking about things or, you know, thinking about me or why I'm doing the things that I'm doing. So I better just keep running. So I just kept running and running and running. And that's how I went all through high school. That's how I went all through university. And in university, I needed to make some extra money in my last year. So, of course, I got a job in a bar. Where else would I work? And, you know, at one point, I used to do ballroom dancing, and we had, like, a salsa night. This is when the Macarena was really the dance to do. And they had hooked me up with this guy, and we were going to advertise Macarena night, you know. And so I would come in on a night that wasn't my shift at, you know, 8 and 9 and 10, whatever, and we would do the Macarena on stage and, you know, promote this evening. And they said, now, Holly, we can either pay you $50 to come in or we can give you 10 drinks. And I was like, are they retarded? I'll take the 10 drinks. Thank you very much. You know, like, why would I take the money? So, of course, I would take the 10 drinks, and I couldn't drink 10 drinks by this point. My liver was doing whatever my liver was doing. It was kind of dying on me. And so I could have fewer and fewer drinks ingested in my system. But I wasn't going to let them get away with that, not paying me those 10 drinks. So I would have 6 drinks and then throw up and then get back out and have 2 more drinks and throw up. And again, this seemed like really normal, logical behavior. And this is a thing I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like our best thinking gets us here. You know, like think upside down. It's like here I was, you know, vice president of the student council, and yet I couldn't figure out that the alcohol was making me physically ill. And not only was it making me physically ill, that was when you wanted to be around me. You know, you didn't want to be around me Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday when I wasn't drinking because I couldn't even get a full breath, you know. It was like that's how I would walk around, just like I couldn't get that full exhale. You know, I was uptight, I was uncomfortable, I was irritated, you were irritating me, they were irritating me, it was just a whole big, you know, I mean, binge drinking. That's what binge drinking was for, like, for me. So I got through university and I started my first job, and my boss wasn't much of a drinker, but he was an eataholic. See, he was constantly eating, and you know, and I didn't want to eat at all because I was throwing up half the day from the night before, you know. So we had this like very strange relationship where he kept wanting us to go out to meals, and you know, and we would entertain clients, and we'd be at the bars on Crescent Street entertaining clients from like 5 at night to 8 o'clock, let's say. And then I would want to, you know, leave so that I could go out with my friends so I could really drink, because I had to business drink, which was, you know, one weeny little glass of wine, and I'm sitting there sipping it, because I don't, you know, I don't want to lose control. Instead of thinking, you know, maybe I shouldn't drink because that's what's making me lose control, I just thought, well, I just don't want to, you know, lose control in front of them. So at 9 o'clock we'd get out, and then I'd call my girlfriends, and then we'd really, you know, tear up the town, and I'd be out till 3 o'clock in the morning, which is when I got dinner, you know, which was always like Kojax and Mir, you know, really square meal, kind of healthy stuff. Go to bed at 4:30 in the morning, and then get up at 7, be so exhausted, be so hungover, be so sick, crawl to my underground parking garage, which my company paid for, which didn't have cameras, and I would change my clothes in the parking garage. I would have like beautifully pressed suits in the trunk. I would take them out. I would take them out of the plastic. I would change. I'd come out in a different set of clothing, and I'd go to the office, and everybody thought I was fabulous. They thought I had it all together. You know, she's got the haircut and the suit, and everything's pressed, and she's got this business card, and it's like, it was all a lie. It was all a lie. And I just, you know, I can't even say today that I didn't want anybody to know about the lie, because I wasn't aware of the lie myself. I really didn't know that, I didn't know what was going on, because I was running, right? So I wasn't stopping to take a look at what was going on. So it's like, I was the last to know. That's kind of how I felt, you know, and the people that I was running with, obviously, I surrounded myself with alcoholics. You know, owners of bars, bartenders, barmaids, other fellow alcoholics. So what I was doing was what they were doing, and that's what people who work do, right? I mean, I was working 12 hours a day, 6-7 days a week. I was allowed to go out to the bars for 5-6 hours a night and drink. This is normal behavior, right? It's like I forgot all my frames of references, you know? I mean, I had lots of, you know, people in my life who had had careers, and yet I couldn't think of one of them who wasn't living this lifestyle that I was living. So cut to, I meet this man who's sober, and he's very well respected in my industry, and everybody was very excited that he was coming to our office to do some business with us. And he came on a Friday. And I know that he came on a Friday because Thursday was $10 all you can drink night on Crescent Street. So Friday was always baseball cap, jeans, and don't talk to me day. So I'm in the back of the office. I turned all my fluorescent overhead bulbs off, by the way, and I had like a little lamp on my desk because I couldn't take all that light and sunshine. So I always had my blinds drawn in this dark little office. And he came into my office, and he did like this double take of me. And not like this double take of me like, wow, she's something to look at. Like this double take like, holy God. And I was like, yeah. I didn't recognize him. I was like, yeah. And he's like, hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm your new client. Oh, gee, you know. So I kind of straighten up as much as I can, but I feel horrible. And one of the things that we used to do at work was we used to take our clients golfing. And I loved golfing. I grew up golfing. Golfing is a really spiritual thing to do, really. You know, for me, you're like out in the middle of nowhere for hours on end in nature, hopefully playing a good enough game that you're not swearing every other shot. And it was always something I really liked to do. So we went out golfing, and it was a little bit painful. I was hungover that morning, too, that we went out golfing. I really didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be with him. I just didn't want to be there, you know. And we finished the round, and that week he called me and said he'd like to go golfing again. And I said, you know, I'll tell my boss. And, you know, he says, no. I don't want your boss coming. I want to go golfing with you. And he was married, and I didn't think he was hitting on me, but I thought, well, this is strange. You know, why would he want to go golfing with me? You should go golfing with my boss. He says, no, just you. Oh, and I'm going to bring my brother-in-law. And I'm thinking, what is he talking about? So I show up at the golf course, and there's his brother-in-law, and I start talking to his brother-in-law, and I realize that his brother-in-law has come in from Toronto just to golf with me. And I'm thinking, what is going on? And we get out in the middle of nowhere, and that's when the two of them hit me with 12-step work. They start telling their stories. Brother-in-law has Al-Anon, you know, decades of Al-Anon under his belt. This guy's got decades of AA in Al-Anon. And the two of them just, like, you know, as I always say, blindsided me. And for 5 hours, all we talked about was drinking and getting sober and, you know, what their experience was like. And it was a really, really powerful day. And, you know, I mean, these are two strangers in my life. And here they are reaching out to me. One of them drove almost 6 hours just to be there. And I was really, really touched. It didn't sink in at first what they were doing, obviously. It took me years in the program to really be able to, you know, to cry about it every time I talk about it. This is one of the first times I'm not. But it really chokes me up, you know, when I see somebody go to that length, you know, to reach out the hand of AA to somebody and really help them, because I don't know what I would have done without them, and I don't know what I would have done without them doing it the way they did. You know, like, I like to go big or go home. Like, they went big or go home. I mean, 5 hours. If they had talked to me for 30 minutes, I would have thought, like, that was an interesting conversation. They had, you know, quite a colorful past, and I would have moved on. But it was more than that. It was like, you know, for me, it's like, when I was asked to come in and talk about my life being completely unmanageable, you know, and taking that first step, that was very, very easy for me. To say that I was an alcoholic was incredibly difficult, and it took me the first year of my sobriety to actually say, my name is Holly and I'm an alcoholic. When I first came to the rooms, I thought this was an anonymous program, to the point that I wasn't supposed to give you my phone number and I wasn't supposed to take yours. We were just supposed to meet and leave. That's what I really thought, you know. I also thought there was one meeting in all of Montreal, and it was in Verdun, which was my first home group. So if I would miss the Monday night meeting, I'd think, I have to wait a whole other week. This sucks. And so I was going to, like, you know, 2-3 meetings a month for my first year. And every so often somebody would say, you know, do you have a sponsor? Are you working the steps? And I thought, where would I get a sponsor? I come here. There's no sponsors here. Like, nobody's talking about sponsorship. Like, what are you talking about? It was a big book study, by the way. And I think I mean, I don't really know how long I've been going to that meeting, but I didn't trust anybody in the meeting. I didn't trust anybody in the meeting. When you say you wanted to help me, I thought there was an ulterior motive. When you said, you know, oh, I heard you share and it just sounds just like me, I thought you were making it up. And but we were reading this book, and if you didn't share, you were booed. Okay, this was like a hard-nailed group. And so I would share. I didn't know what the hell I was sharing about, you know, but I would share every week. So we'd talk about steps. I hadn't done any of the steps. The sixth step, you know, it's all about blah, blah, blah. And finally, at the end of the meeting, I went up to the chairperson. I said, I think I lost this book. This book that we talk about, this we read from, I think I lost it somewhere. I mean, I never had it to begin with. And, you know, he didn't try to embarrass me or humiliate me. He said, we've been saving this one for you. And that's still the book that I have today and that I use, and has all these names and numbers in the front of the book. That's what this group used to do. They used to put all the names and numbers in the front of the book for the newcomer. And when they gave me that book, I can't tell you how touched I was, you know. But did I read it? No, I didn't read it. Of course not, because I had a job and I had a life and I was still running. So, you know, I went through my first year of sobriety, and I did have a sponsor, although she didn't believe in going to meetings because it was a cult. So we met privately. And so she gave me my third-month chip, my six-month chip, and then she didn't have a nine-month chip because she had stopped going to AA after that. So she just said, oh, it's 9 months, yay, you know, kind of thing. And she took me through my first year. And I have to say, you know, it's not the way that it's outlined in the book, but it kept me sober, because when it comes down to it was one alcoholic keeping another alcoholic sober. And she had 3 years of sobriety, even though I don't know that she'd, you know, worked all the steps. And today, unfortunately, I'm sad to say she's drinking. But she kept me sober because she knew more than I did. You know, she'd been to more meetings than I had at that point, and she kept me sober. So my first year came and went, and my second year, I was coming up on my second year, and I started to smell red wine in the building where I worked. I didn't even drink red wine because it always gave me a headache, but I started to drink red wine. And the internet was still kind of new, which sounds really strange to say. And long-distance calls were expensive. But I emailed this man who had 12-stepped me, who I'd stayed in contact with. And I emailed him, I smell red wine everywhere. Send. That's all I wrote. And he wrote me back, what's your phone number? And so I gave him my number at work, and he called me, and he said, I want you to get to a meeting. I've called a intergroup, which I didn't know what that was, and he said, I found a meeting for you tonight. And I thought, they've started a second meeting. It's not Monday. And I said to him, I'll go wherever it is. And so he gave me the address. I showed up at the meeting. I don't know that I raised my hand or said hello or anything, but I was very, very grateful that the meeting was there. You know, and if there's anybody who sat in the meeting tonight and you haven't said hello to anybody and you haven't shaken anybody's hand, it's just great that you're in the room. You know, I mean, getting from my apartment to a room to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was a really, really long journey for me that took me a long time to get. And I'd like to say that I came to that meeting, got involved, did my steps, but no. Running continued. And so I started going to more meetings, and, you know, I think I was going to 2 meetings a week, and, you know, I was, like, really committed to AA, and I would tell people, you know, how committed I was, and still hadn't done any of the steps. And a woman turned to me and said, you know, there's a women's meeting, and it's starting, and it's on Saturday mornings. I'm like, just women? Yeah, just women. Okay, I'll try that. So I started going to this women's meeting, and that's where I started to get sober. I found a sponsor, and I started working the steps with her. And I got to about step six. We started working step six, and she kind of disappeared. And I tried to follow her, but she wasn't available any longer. So I was stuck at step six, and I thought, this is really great. I've done half the steps. Like, I'm an amazing example of AA. So I went through life like that, and I have to say, again, step one, big. Step two, big. Any step you do, congratulations. Like, you're getting more sober. There are, however, 12 steps to complete, and I highly suggest, as does the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you do all 12. But if you do 6, more power to you, okay? So my experience was that I did the 6th step, and then I coasted a little bit longer, and then life really started to pick up. And dreams of mine started to come true, and things I thought I would never get to do, I started doing, and not only was I running, I was like in a marathon, you know, and I was like running with all these different people, and I was just busy. I was too busy for AA, you know. I would chair meetings, and I'd clean up, and I'd do things, and I had a home group, but, you know, AA was still this thing that I did, I think, almost like an extracurricular activity, I think is how I saw it. I moved to New York City 6 years ago, And I moved there because I fell in love with a man. Isn't that a great reason to move to New York City? And I always thought, like, oh, well, what am I doing? I'm waiting to fall in love, right? I mean, isn't that what women want? They want to fall in love and be with somebody. And, you know, so I followed my husband down to New York City, and I thought, wow, I'm going to arrive in New York City, and they're going to say, welcome. Where have you been? Except that's not what happened. I couldn't get a visa. I left my very big business card, where I was national manager of a big corporation in Canada. And in New York City, it was like, Holly who? And so I started going to meetings every day. Not because I wanted to, because I had to. Because I was hitting an emotional bottom in sobriety, which I don't advise. Which is why I wish I had done all 12 steps, because I know that it wouldn't have come to that. But, you know, you have to hit your bottom when you hit your bottom. Yeah? Okay. So I hit this emotional bottom, and I went into blame mode. I went into, like, full-on resentment mode, where I was resentful at New York City, at the government of the United States of America, of the Immigration Department, of the visa people, my husband, who had to come home to this raging lunatic every night, who was so bitter for him falling in love with her and, you know, dragging her to New York City. And I sat in these meetings, and I was going back and forth to Montreal all the time because I was so lonely. I was so homesick. And I was chairing a meeting. And when you chair in New York, you chair for 6 months. It's a big commitment. So 6 months I'm chairing this meeting. I don't know anybody, and I have to find a speaker every week too. So I have to find 24 speakers. I don't know anybody. So it was a big challenge for me. And I decided that I just couldn't do it, and I was just going to start asking people when they came through the door, which everybody was so scared of me, let me tell you, that I was going to ask them to speak every week. But I flew back, and I literally flew back. I had my luggage in hand. I came running into the church, and there was one woman in the church sitting there. And I went up to her, and I said, do you have a year of continuous sobriety? Yes. And I said, oh, good. Would you like to speak for me? This woman got up and spoke, and for the first time, she gave a message of everything I wanted. She told her story, and she had everything I wanted. And essentially, all I wanted at that point was to go through the big book page by page. That's what I really wanted. I decided that what I was doing was not working. I was miserable. I was sober. I wasn't spiritually fit. I was full of resentment. You know, I wanted to do another fourth step. I didn't have anybody to do it with. And she kept saying, you know, and I've gone through the big book page by page. And I thought, yeah. So I went up to her at the end of the meeting, and I said, where do you go? What meetings do you go to? And she gave me the name of her home group. And when she left, and this is not all of New York City, but New York City is divided by Fifth Avenue from the east side to the west side. And the west side doesn't go to the east side meetings, and the east side doesn't go to the west side meetings. Not like that for everybody, but this was a general... this was what was told to me by the members of my current home group. Well, you know, she's on the east side. You're not going to go to a meeting there. I said, well, what do they do on the east side? Well, they read the big book and they do the steps. Woo! I was all excited. So time went by. Of course, I did nothing because that's what I like to do. Nothing about my pain. Oh, you know, poor me, poor me, pour me another drink, but I won't do anything about it. So I sat on my laurels for several months, I want to say, and anyway, this same man's wife told me that her sponsee was moving to New York City, and would I take her to a meeting? So she calls me up, and she says, this is the meeting I want to go to, and it's the same meeting that's been suggested to me by this woman that I met. I said, I'll go to this meeting with you. And we're sitting in the meeting, and I realize I think I've been to this meeting before. And at some point in the meeting, they said, if you want to be a member of this meeting, come see our membership committee at the piano.